Hi, everybody. My name's Doug Rowell, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I want to thank Richard for calling me, and Deborah for emailing me, and Don for picking me up in his badass truck and driving me around today. And and I also want to thank the people who had to do with putting on this skit. I'm from Tujunga, California. Don thought he was pretty slick getting away with saying Southern California. He actually could have said L.A., and it would have been pretty close. But Tujunga is in the San Fernando Valley, and every year, San Fernando Valley, we put on a show, a musical comedy, because we're in L.A. We got all this talent down there, and it's easy to guilt them into, you know, hey, well, you know, can't you give something for your sobriety, you know? And we get all these people, all these professional musicians and singers and dancers and, you know, stagehands and so forth come in and we put on these shows. So I appreciate the show. I appreciate what it takes to put on a show like this. And besides that, I'm recently retired. Well, not recently, a year and a half retired from working in television. And I the last 7 years I was a prop man on The Price is Right. You know, so and I'll tell you something else about L.A. There's a lot of sober people in L.A. There's 2,400 meetings a week in Los Angeles. And there's every kind of meeting there. You know, it's like there's some meetings where you are expected to wear a tie and a jacket if you're going to be at the podium, and there are other meetings where you're expected to park your motorcycle inside the room. And but a lot of people work in the business in L.A. Nobody in around the country. The business means different things, but in L.A. it means showbiz, you know, and so there's a lot of people working in show business, and there's a lot of sober alcoholics. So, almost any show that I spent 25 years working in that business, and the last 7 years working on The Price is Right. Okay, I was the head prop. There was a guy, or a woman on my crew who was sober about 2 years behind me. We had the art director who was, he was new at this point I'm going to tell you about. He had about a year of sobriety. And then there was the scenic artist who had 17 years of sobriety. So there was a lot of us around there. And, you know, sometimes the meeting would just be, you know, we walk it through the hallway doing your job going, hey, one day at a time, you know, keep it simple, something like that, you know. And, you know, easy does it, yeah. And but occasionally we'd have a little coffee break. We'd, you know, get together, and, you know, it'd be like a real meeting all of a sudden right in the middle of work. And one time the art director, who was fairly new, you know, he was a year sober compared to the rest of us, he was fairly new, and he had a stress job, you know, and he said to us, tell me something, you guys, how do you keep from getting frazzled from this thing? I said, what? He said, how do you let the stress, you know? And the scenic artist said, what stress? And he said, you know, how long does it take you to leave this stuff behind you when you go home? And I said, I don't take this home with me. I'm usually okay by the time I get to my car. And he said, how do you do that? How do you do that? And at that time at CBS, it was in West Hollywood at the corner of Fairfax and Beverly, and there was one wall was all window at that time, and you could look out at the corner of Fairfax and Beverly and see, you know, the world out there. And so I took him over to the window. I said, come here. Okay, here's the deal. Life, game show. And you know, and the thing is, he thought it was clever. I thought it was clever too, you know, when I heard myself say it. But it's one of those things. It's one of those things that your sponsor says to you, or you hear yourself saying to somebody you sponsor, because some of that stuff that we say that has the ring of wisdom really doesn't come from us. And I have had to use that myself on a number of occasions since then. You know, when I get stressed out over something, go, oh, wait a minute, this is one of those life game show deals. So it's a good metaphor for me to to keep things straight. Anyway, I don't even know why I brought that. Oh, yeah, because of your skit in the game show. Okay, so we're done with the game show portion of the talk. I love doing this. It just tickles me to no end that somebody can call me from Montana, and say, "Hi, you don't know me, but would you like to come to Montana and talk about yourself for an hour?" Yeah! yes, I would. How much is it going to cost? Oh, no, we'll pay all your expenses. and usually when you arrive, somebody meets you and says, "Can we get you anything? Are you hungry? We've got you a nice hotel room," and they got me a beautiful hotel room, and I want to say, I didn't invent anything, I just spent a long time in my life hurting everybody who ever cared about me, falling down, breaking things, and losing things. Yep, you're the guy, all right. I'll do it. And yet, I know some people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know some very, very good speakers who hate doing it. They hate being asked, but they do it anyway. I'm not like that. I don't even know if I'm a good speaker, and I couldn't care less. But I love doing it. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to. But they didn't ask. I was a little drunk that night. And it's pretty rare that they ever go, "Hey, let's get the drunk guy to talk." So I remember some stuff about that meeting, though. There was when I went to my first AA meeting, I was a little embarrassed for y'all, because I didn't know. I knew you could get. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister, and she ran a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, down on the docks of Los Angeles Harbor, and on Beacon Street, which is a real tough area of the Los Angeles Harbor. And my grandmother ran this Skid Row mission down there, and she helped drunks to get sober, feeding them soup and Jesus. So I knew you could get sober on soup and Jesus. It just never seemed worth it to me. And of course, I had friends who got sober in AA, and they never said anything about that God thing to me, So I thought that AA was like the secular way to get sober, the way that the smart people got sober without God. And I just assumed that. Nobody ever told me that. It just seemed like that to me. And so when I went to AA and I saw all the stuff about God as you understand him, and higher power and power greater than yourself, trust God, clean house, help, oh my gosh, I thought, oh man, oh no. I stayed anyway, and I didn't sit down. It was a meeting. The first meeting was a meeting of about 50, 60 people, and there were empty chairs around the room and places I could sit down, but it seemed like if I sat down, it would be like, "Oh yeah, I'm joining up," and I'm not a joiner, I never fit any place in my life. I knew I wouldn't fit here. I didn't fit in school. I didn't fit in the workplace. I didn't fit in my own family. I just didn't fit. When I was in school, I played football. I loved playing football, but I wasn't a jock, and I knew it, and the jocks knew it. I surfed. I like surfing. I used to go down and surf all the time. Surfed with the surfers, but I wasn't a surfer. And I knew I wasn't a surfer, and the surfers knew I wasn't a surfer. And I liked to ride motorcycles and build motorcycles. I did that since I was 15 years old. It was an obsession with me, but I wasn't a biker, and I knew it, and the bikers knew it. So So when I came in here, I knew I wouldn't fit here because I never fit in place in my life, and I was used to not fitting, and I liked not fitting, to tell the truth. I had no idea that I just walked into the biggest organization of misfits the world's ever seen. Because you didn't appear to be misfits. You all appeared to be people who used to drink, but now you don't drink anymore, and you're real happy about that. In fact, you're just delighted about it. And so I wasn't like that. So I didn't want to sit down. I kind of leaned against the wall in the back, crossed my arms and leaned against the wall, and there was another guy who leaned against the wall back there. It was a cool section, you know. You did some stuff. You did some stuff at that meeting that was very, very lame. It was real lame. In fact, I don't know if you have, some places in the country, they don't have birthday cakes. In Southern California, they have birthday cakes. My home group is called the Winner's Attitude Adjustment Group. It's a one-hour meeting. We meet at 7 a.m. every day of the year in the Little Brown Church in Studio City. And you can come to our meeting, walk in there, nobody's ever seen you before, we don't even know if you're sober or an alcoholic, and say, I'd like to take a cake. And the secretary will bring out a cake and put candles in it, and we'll sing to you, and then you can talk for as long as you feel like you need to talk. You might talk 15 minutes into a one-hour book study, and then we say, thank you, keep coming back, you know. So that's what we do with birthdays, or anniversaries, as they call them in some places. My first meeting in Southern California, I went and I didn't know about the birthday thing. None of my sober friends had ever told me about it. And they said, Ruth is celebrating 18 years tonight. So I'm looking around for some 18-year-old tiny hiney to get up and, oh, that's nice, Ruth's having a birthday. And this woman got up, Ruth was 50 if she was a day. And I thought, she's 18, she ought to stop drinking. Yeah, because it's not working for her. But then I realized what it was. It hit me. Oh, my God, they're celebrating, of course. This woman has not had a drink in 18 years. And while I'm soaking that up, they start singing, Happy Birthday to you. And I'm looking around and everybody's into it. I'm not. I'm in the cool section, you know. Keep coming back. And she blew out the candles. And I'm thinking, this is some level of lameness that I could not have imagined. If I was going to make stuff up about to make fun of AA, I wouldn't have thought of that birthday thing. So Ruth gets up and she says, I'm Ruth, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Ruth. And she said, I want you to know that over this last 18 years of sobriety, I have attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. See, somebody said, wow. You know, a lot of people in that room said, wow. And I didn't. Oh, I sort of did. Wow. But I thought, well, you kind of dumb, ain't you? Yeah, you're a little slow, ain't you, honey? Because, see, I'm a quick study. I'm like a hum a few bars and I'll fake it kind of guy. You know, I don't know how long it's going to take me to get this thing, but I know that it's not going to take every day for 18 years. I'm just convinced of that. And so... Good for you, Ruth. That's good. But I'm back there leaning against the wall in the cool section, and this other guy who's leaning against the wall, I thought he was cool, but he wasn't cool. He was a newcomer catcher. You know, I didn't know you had them. And he comes over and he nudges me and goes, hey, I'll tell you what. You stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. Really? Well, just don't drink for a year, huh? Can I get a cake? No, I'll tell you, I'm not a big pastry eater. And if I wanted one, I'd just like stop at Safeway on the way home. I mean, actually, I'm going to stop and get a six pack. It wouldn't even be out of my way. But thanks. I knew he meant well, and I was happy for all of them. But I'll tell you a couple of things that happened though at that first meeting. That was one that stuck in my mind, and another one was at the coffee break. Three separate people, three individuals, and not together, two men and a woman, came up to me. You know, not like walking by, hey, how you doing, dude? You know, came up to me, hi. Put out their hand and said, you're new. It wasn't a question. They said, you're new. And I said, yeah. And they said, keep coming back. Three separate people came up to me, put out their hand and told me to keep coming back. And we were talking about that tonight at dinner. You know, you remember people who do that to you. And yet we do that to people. And sometimes we're not, I was telling Dick tonight, I might be saying, hey, listen, it's good to have you here. Keep coming back. Meanwhile, I'm looking at cookies over here going, what kind of cookies they got? You know, those Oreos or chocolate chips. But the person who I'm saying keep coming back to may remember years later that I welcomed him to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So it's always good to put out your hand. But nobody was telling me keep coming back. You know, people who genuinely cared about me were saying, stay away from here. Don't come over here, Doug. Okay, you know, it's like, hi, it's Doug. You know, you guys going to be home for a while? You know, no, we're not, Doug. You caught us. We were just going out the door. We're not going to be here for a long, long time. Okay, then. Love you, Mom. You know, maybe this will give you the picture. I was uninvited to a wedding. I was disinvited to a wedding. I had been invited. I was invited. I RSVP'd. I bought him a wedding present. The wedding was a few days away. And my friend Bob called and he said, Doug, Carol and I have been talking about it and we decided to ask you not to come to the wedding. Now, you think most people, most non-alcoholic people would say, oh, why is that, Bob? You know, like something I did, or did you just overbook, or you know? And it didn't even occur to me to ask him. I just said, "Oh, okay," because I knew why. Whenever there's a function where there's drinking around, my behavior is not predictable, and so they didn't want me screwing up the most important day of their life. And also, we had been at a wedding the weekend before, and all of us and my circle of friends and. Long story short, I mooned the bride's mother, and it's considered a social faux pas in some circles. And I didn't go there to moon the bride's mother. I'm sure it's not like I was driving over there going, boy, I can hardly wait to moon the bride's mother. You know, but it just I was drinking and everybody was having a good time, and I thought, wouldn't it be funny to show my ass? A lot of people will say, man, that Doug is crazy. And of course they did, but it didn't have the connotation that I was hoping for. But and people would come up to me, you know, and say, "What's wrong with you? How could you moon the bride's mother?" Sorry, I thought it was the groom's mother. No, come on, hey, lighten up, man. God, it wasn't at the ceremony, it was at the reception. For Christ, what am I, an animal? You know, and that's when I got the nickname Doug Scusting, and that stuck. It stuck for a while. So what I'm saying is, for three strangers to tell me to keep coming back, I remember thinking, I think these people see my potential. And the secretary of that meeting said, she said, if you're new here tonight, don't leave here without this book. So I left with the book. I bought the book. And I took it home. And I read the, well, I didn't read it, but I poured a drink and sat down and thumbed through it. And I have this ability to look at the title of any chapter in any book and know everything that's in the chapter. It's a, you know, it's a gift that I have. And so I'm looking through this book, and I got, you know, doctor's opinion. Like, I never had one of those. Yeah, you ought to not drink so much. Okay, I know what's in there. Bill's story, chapter one, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter two, there's a solution. Oh, I know what that is. That's a sales pitch. Hey, there's a solution to your problem, young man. Okay, I know what's all that. More about alcoholism. I'm sure that's fascinating for a later read. And then I got to chapter four, we agnostics. And my alcoholic brain perceived this. Ah, here's how the smart people got sober without God. So I read that chapter. And I got done with that chapter, and I thought, I must have spaced out, because I totally missed the whole smart people stay sober without God thing. So I poured another drink and read it again, and I did this about half a dozen times. Evidently missed the first paragraph where it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, then you're probably an alcoholic. And if this be the case, you may be suffering from a disease which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You know, where's the smart people thing? You know, that's like. But I read that chapter several times that night, and some stuff started to leak in, started to soak into my brain. One of the things was, about the fifth or sixth time I read it, I saw this subtle little sentence that I think it's so subtle that most of us miss it, at least on the first read. It says, we have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Isn't that an interesting thing? It's real subtle, isn't it? We have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Evidently, the finding is in the seeking. Because this is not what I heard at my grandmother's mission. My Pentecostal grandmother indicated to me, anything I say about organized religion is not an indictment of organized religion. I'm talking about my alcoholic, drunken perception of what organized religion was. But it seemed to me that my grandmother's church said, if you want God to even hear your prayers, you must be baptized. You must be baptized. Oh, yes, and not sprinkled like some damn Methodist either. No. No, I'm talking about soaked. I'm talking about dunked. I'm talking about washed in the blood of the Lamb. Coming up, shaking your head. Somebody give me a towel. And here was Alcoholics Anonymous saying God doesn't make too hard terms. I had a girlfriend who was Catholic, and it seemed to me that she had to go to communion and confession and a whole bunch of other things, only not even to talk to God. She still couldn't talk to God. She could just, like, talk to his mom, you know, hello, Mrs. God, you know, it's Patty, you know, tell him I love him, you know, my friend Michael was Jewish. See, I had an eclectic religious upbringing. My friend Michael was Jewish. And Michael and I would go out to lunch, and he would order a BLT. Hold the bacon, please. And dude, you just ordered a salad on toast, you know? I don't know what that is. Well, I don't want to get God pissed off at me, you know? It's like. So, you know, and then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims, oh my, and it just seemed like everybody had a different way that you had to approach God. And so I had way too much education in LSD to believe in God or anything the least bit mystical. And I made no distinction between Mother Teresa and Osama bin Laden, you know. If it was mystical, I don't want anything to do with it. And if anybody, by the way, is offended that I mention drugs, which I just did in an AA meeting, my apology. It's just that it's part of my story, and I didn't know, you know, what my story was going to be or where I was going to use it. And like somebody would say, I mean, if I had known, I mean, the first time somebody said, hey, man, try this, I would have said, thanks, but I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years, and I don't want to piss anybody off, you know. But I only used every drug I ever heard of. Except for ones that I've heard of since I got sober. And I'm curious. Ecstasy, that's a nice name, isn't it? That sounds like something I would have liked, you know, but that's why we have newcomers. Good to talk to newcomers. Did you ever try that ecstasy stuff? Yes, I did. How was it? Well, I'm here. Okay, all right, that's all I need to know. And so, here was Alcoholics Anonymous in the big book in chapter 4 saying, "We have found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek Him." So we found. So that got my interest a little bit. Then I went on to read one of my favorite sentences in the book, written about me, I'm sure, before I was born. And it says, "To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face." Got a couple giggles. This is a sentence designed for alcoholics to read. Because when we do, we go, "That's right. That's a pretty hard decision to make, all right. Alcoholic death or a spiritual life." Now, I have yet to meet an earth person who has a hard time with this decision. In fact, here's one you can test. You know, get yourself a clipboard and go stand in front of a Walmart sometime. Really. And stop people when they're coming out. "Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life?" Yeah. And see what the normies have to say about it, because they generally don't have a hard time. The very, very curious normie who might say something like, "Now, when you say alcoholic death, you mean the one where you puff up and turn yellow and choke to death on your own blood and vomit? Your esophagus erupts?" "Well, yeah. You know, but not right away, you know." "Yeah, all right, no, you got to lose everything first, you know." "You got to hurt everybody you ever cared about." But yeah, that's the yellow puff-up thing later on. What do you think? Now go get in the long line. You know, they all will. In fact, if you do this survey and somebody, and you ask them, "Excuse me, alcoholic death, spiritual life," and you get this. "Are you going to be here tomorrow?" You know, they're on our team, you know. Yeah, tell them, "What are you doing Saturday night? You want to go someplace with me Saturday?" You know. So this got my attention. This got my attention a little bit, reading chapter 4 over and over and over. But I didn't stop drinking. I went to AA for 8 months. I didn't have a home group. You know, I didn't want to get really too close to anybody, but I started like falling in love with AA, really, because I started to realize that this, I do fit. I remember once when I was still drinking, I went to AA, and people were sharing, and I identified with everything everybody said in the room, and I thought, "God, I'm in a room full of Dougs." Oh, no. Oh, no, I'm joining up. And I was going to meetings, but I didn't want to get really too close, and I didn't have a home group, and I didn't have a sponsor, and I didn't read the big book except for occasionally chapter 4, looking for loopholes, and I didn't have a commitment, and I didn't take the steps, and I was drinking every day. But other than that, I had a pretty good program, I went home one night from a meeting. Very often I would stop and buy a bottle of whiskey on the way to a meeting. It's not a good thing to do, I guess. I would think, you know, like, okay, if it's a good meeting, then I won't drink it. You know, I'd leave it sealed under the seat and go to the meeting. And then there wasn't any good meetings in 1986. And fortunately, because then I would have had to throw away a perfectly good bottle of whiskey. So I would go home and drink this bottle of whiskey. And I did this on a regular basis. I went home one night after I'd been going to AA for 8 months. I did an experiment one time, actually, before I came to AA. Somebody had told me that if you don't drink for 3 days, that all the alcohol is out of your system, in case you have to have some kind of test, or, you know, you're going to get tested for something. So I thought, oh, well, that would be an interesting thing to try and see how. I think I could go 3 days without a drink. I never tried it. You know, I like drinking. At midnight this one day, I decided, okay, starting midnight, I'm going to go 3 days without a drink. So midnight, it's midnight, no more drinking. So I went to bed pretty early that night. And then I got up the next morning, I made my coffee, and I started to get out the whiskey to pour in the coffee. Oh, that's right, 3 days without drinking, I'm going to be sober, you know. So I just drank my coffee, and I went to work. Come coffee break, it's like I really wanted to get a beer or a half pint or something, but I didn't. I just, you know, had coffee and talked to the guys and stuff. And at lunch, guys were drinking beer at lunch, but I didn't. I just drank soda and ate my lunch and went back to work. And then we were done at working at 4 o'clock, and I started home, and I'm thinking, going home, God, you know, I haven't had a drink since midnight. Midnight to noon is 12 hours, and then to 4 is what, 16 hours, almost 18 hours. 18 hours is... three-quarters of a day, three-quarters of a day is almost a day, and if I can go one day, I can go 3 days, so I might as well just get something and drink it. So that was the only time I ever went actually 3 days without drinking, which lasted 16 hours. So that's probably had to do something with the reason that I was a little skeptical about stopping drinking. I really didn't care for it. But this one night that I went home and I had my fifth of whiskey, and I was laying on the floor drinking and watching TV, and I passed out, and that happened all the time. I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning, turned off the TV, got my half a bottle of whiskey, crawled on my hands and knees across the living room through the hallway into the bedroom to go to bed. And when I got in there, I stood up to take off my clothes, and I had this bottle in my hand, and I lost my balance, and I fell on my knees next to the bed, and I spilled this whiskey in it. Picked up the bottle real quick, and there was about this much left in the bottom, but most of it was spilled on the bed, and it was making its little puddle. You know, it's making this little whiskey lake in the middle of my bed. And I watched. I set the bottle down in a safe place, and grabbed this bedspread, and I started sucking the whiskey out of it, just sucking for all I was worth. And a voice in my head said, "Hey, man, that ain't right." You know, and that's true. There's whiskey in the bottle, man. Are you thirsty? I'm not thirsty. I'm, you know, frugal. I saw myself sucking this whiskey out of the bedspread, and I just felt wrong about it, and I felt alone and lost. And I thought, I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I have not learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. I'm not paying attention. I really did feel lost. I can joke about it, but I just felt absolutely lost. And I did something I don't even think was very smart. What I did was I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I meant it. I absolutely meant it. I didn't think there was anybody listening. It's not like all of a sudden I came to believe. I just didn't know what else to do. It was a prayer of desperation, and I can't even say for sure if I knew it was a prayer when I said it. But I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I just surrendered. I went to bed. I went to sleep. Now, I didn't quit drinking. The next day, I got up, and I went to work. I went to my favorite liquor store, my neighborhood liquor store, on the way home from work. And I went in to get a half pint, and there was a guy from AA behind the counter of the liquor store. That couldn't happen. I knew everybody that was ever behind the counter of that liquor store. But there was an AA guy behind the counter. Hey, what are you doing here? He said, what are you doing here? So then I was in a restaurant a couple days later and started to order a drink in a part of town that I wasn't used to being in. and the waitress was somebody I knew from AA. You know, hey, and I'm in the market in the liquor department, reaching up for a bottle to put in my shopping cart, and there's a gal from AA pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time, keep it simple. Isn't it a beautiful life? You know, and these kind of things were happening every day for a couple of weeks. To be these AA people. And one day, after a couple of weeks of this, I was on the way to work, about 6:15. I just killed a half pint of whiskey, and I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal in California, and they're useless, too. So I rolled down the window, and there's a guy from AA driving towards me at 6:15 in the morning. And he waves, and I throw a bottle out the window. And I thought, what? Where are these people coming from? Everywhere I go, there's these AA people. They're like cockroaches. They just come at you. The sun comes up. Hey, let's have a meeting. Really? Have we seen a person fail? You know, and... and I thought, you know, it's like those miracles that they talk about in meetings. And as soon as I thought the word miracle, as soon as the word miracle came into my mind, it was sort of like I could hear God laughing. You know, and I remembered that I had been on my knees and said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I thought, I'm a victim of miracles. I asked for help. I got the help, just like they say. It's the moment that I came to believe. It's the moment that I came to believe. You know, I can't express it any differently than that. And it's the moment that I started to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to talk about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous because the lyrics are very confusing. You know, when you're new, when I was new, I must say, the lyrics were the words, just the words. You know, when they all those regular things they tell you, like, well, you got to surrender to win. You know, it's like, okay, you got to give it away to keep it. Well, I know what that is. That means put some money in the basket. You know, give it away to keep it. And you know, and I'd hear people say, it's a couple of people say, well, the road gets narrower. And I asked this one guy, What is that road gets narrower thing? You know, is that a good thing? You know, it seems like it would be inconvenient. You know, I did a lot of one-eyed driving, and it seemed like it's something you wouldn't want. And he said, no. You know, here's an example. He said, when I first got sober, I used to smoke, and I would be driving down the street, and I'd throw my cigarette butts out the window. I did it all the time. And then one day, it just hit me. I don't know if it was from God or what, but I just realized I could start a fire. You know, throwing a cigarette. I need to be responsible and throwing them out the window. And then I realized I'm also littering. Okay, it's just a cigarette butt, but it's contributing to the litter of the world. And so I started putting them in the ashtray, and then I dumped my ashtray in a trash can. And eventually, I even quit smoking. He said, so, you know, I think that's what it means. Now, I understand that. Once somebody explained it to me, I understand that. And so I'm walking around in AA going, well, the road gets narrower, you know. You want to know what that means, you know? Well, but when Bob used to smoke, you know, one day I said there was a guy. He wasn't even talking to me. He was talking to some guys he sponsored, and he said, you know, I'll tell you what, Alcoholics Anonymous is full of beautiful women, beautiful in every way. You know, they're beautiful in the way they dress, the way they look, the way they act, the way they talk. They're smart, funny women, sexy women, but I don't play. I leave them alone. I'm a married man, and I don't play. And I said, the road gets narrower. And he said, excuse me? He said, the road gets narrower, huh? He said, where'd you get that? See, I shouldn't even have been in the conversation, but I thought he'd be happy for my input. But he said, where'd you get that? I said, in the big book? Well, I didn't, you know. But I heard a lot of people get away with a lot of crap, you know, saying it came out of the big book. So I said, the big book, and he knew the book, and so I shouldn't have said that. He said, isn't that interesting? Because my book doesn't say anything about the road getting narrower. I thought, we got the same book. Maybe you got a different one, because my book, on page 55, it says, why don't you come and join us on the broad highway? Not the narrow road, the broad highway. And then on 75, it says, you're going to feel like you're walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe, guess where? on the broad highway. Yeah, don't say nothing about no road getting narrower. Where'd you get that, son? I said, you know, I was just trying to help. And I was embarrassed, and guys were laughing at me, but I hadn't started to hear the music. Once I started to hear the music, the words started to make sense. I could dig the lyrics, you know. When I took my first honest 30-day chip, now, I don't know if they have chips here. In Southern California, they give chips to help you, you know, so you feel good about, you know, 30 days and 60 days and 90 days and 6 months and 9 months. And so I had taken a lot of different chips. One time I took a chip at a group I had never been at because I heard somebody at the coffee, a girl talking to her friend, said, my sponsor says I can't have sex for 6 months. So I took a six-month chip at that meeting and... you know, just in case I might get lucky. And I wish I had a picture of me at that meeting. I couldn't have got lucky in a women's prison with a pocket full of pardons, you know. But just in case. So what I'm saying is, but by the time I got sober, I had enough chips to open a casino. But when I actually had 30 days and got up at the Burbank group to take my first honest 30-day chip, and they said, anybody for sober 30 days? And I got up and I took the chip and I said, my name's Doug, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Doug. And I felt like part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like part of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time. And I sat down and I was just glowing. And I remember feeling just as happy about this guy who I didn't care for taking a 9-month chip as I was about my own 30-day chip. And I thought, what's that? What is that? You know, and people took cakes. And I was part of this thing. And I, at the coffee break, I started to go get my coffee, and as a guy stopped me, and he said, congratulations on your 30 days. I said, thanks. And he said, you know what the secret is? I said, no, don't drink, I guess. And he said, hang on. Just hang on. You think you can do that? And I said, yeah, I can do that. I've been doing it 30 days now, you know. And so I started to go get my coffee, and there's a guy at the Burbank group named Jim B. He's one of these glad-handed, back-slapping alcoholics. I've seen him all over AA, all over the country, you know. Said, son, congratulations on your 30 days. And I said, thank you. And he said, you know what the secret is? I said, yep, hang on. And he said, nope, let go. All right. So the secret's hang on, no, let go. So, but I didn't care. I'd already started to hear the music. That's why the words didn't bother me. I know the guy that said hang on is talking about keep coming back. He's talking about stay close. You know, Jim that told me let go is talking about let go and let God. Because once you start to hear the music, the words just cook. The way you can, you know, I'll give an 86, Dick. You can dance to it. You know what I'm saying? In chapter 5 that's read at most meetings, Jason read tonight, it talks about honesty. A lot in chapter 5. Rigorous honesty. Not some regular honesty. Rigorous honesty, whatever that is. And those who don't get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And even people with grave emotional and mental disorders can get sober if they have the capacity to be honest. You know, and I remember thinking, I don't know if I'm honest enough to stay sober. I don't know. You know, I'm not a particularly honest person. The closest I ever came to real honesty when my ex-wife said, you know, asked me if I slept with her sister, and I said, not a wink. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's a stretch, you see. And I'm not 100% honest today. I'm 14 years and 9 months sober, and sometimes I lie. You know, I only do it when I'm divinely directed. And you can tell, can't you, Dick? You know when God wants you to lie. You know, like when my wife says, honey, does this dress make me look fat? Rigorous honesty. No, baby, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs. Yeah. Yeah, really, because the dress looked fine on the hanger. But let's go try it on the skinny chick next door. If it makes her look fat, then it's the dress, all right, you know. That's called rigorous stupidity, and I don't need to do that. A little white lie will suffice in that case. And if a waiter says to me, this happens to me all the time, waiters in a nice restaurant will say, sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And I just lie to them, you know. I say, oh, no, thank you. You know, because I mean, rigorous honesty. Boy, you know what? I would like a cocktail instead of dinner. I'd like, yeah, I like a double Bushmills neat and a margarita back and keep them coming. I got a pocket full of plastic and I'm a big old tipper. We gonna party tonight. No, I'm just kidding, son. Don't. No, don't bring me any drink, because I got this disease. It's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy, for Christ's sake. You don't want that in your nice restaurant, do you? You know? No, just the coffee is fine, and you know. Yeah. When you start to hear the music, then that's when the words start to make sense, you know. When I finally got sober, I don't hold a record, but it seemed like 8 months was a long time to me, you know, to just come around drinking every day. And I was desperate to stay sober. I wanted to be here now. And so I was listening. And if anybody said, our big book says, and I was all ears, because I don't want to do that road gets narrower thing again, you know, So the option was either listen when somebody's talking about the book or go ahead and read the damn thing. So I'm listening. This woman said, let me tell you something, too. If you're new, you might as well. I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. Most people in here know this. There are people with considerable time in Alcoholics Anonymous who will misquote this book from the podium. I may have done it tonight. I don't know. I hope not, but it doesn't matter. The actual print never changes. So if you want to know what's in it, go ahead and read it. Otherwise, you may hear somebody who doesn't mean to mislead you misquote the book. And that's what happened to me. I heard this woman say, our book says, I'm listening, our book says that our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions. It does say that. It says exactly that. But then she went on to add her own stuff without saying, this is my opinion. She said, and if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you will drink again. And I thought, oops. Whoops, because I have no clue what my deeper underlying cause and condition is. You know, somebody said to me when I was in high school, if you get her drunk, you'll get a home run with her, you know, and so I did, he was right. It turned out it was the first time I ever got drunk, and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness, and I just thought, well, this is good stuff. I'm gonna keep doing this, and so I drank, but I wouldn't call it a deeper underlying cause and condition. I don't come from an alcoholic family like many of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do. One of the reasons I thought I wasn't going to fit when I got here. I never had a drink till I was 18. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. My dad was the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer and drink one and put five in the refrigerator and leave them there. You know what I'm saying? Leave them there for a week. You know, I mean, I got nothing against refrigerators. I just don't think it should get five when I should get one. And my dad would like be doing something on a Saturday afternoon, be working in the yard or working on his car or watching a football game or something, and he'd stop and have a beer. And then he would go back to what he was doing. And I don't understand that kind of drinking. I say, if I have a beer, that's what I'm doing. And my mother may be an alcoholic. I don't know, because she won't drink. And you can't tell. You can't tell if they won't drink, you know. And I asked her one time after I was sober, because I'm interested in this genetic predisposition thing, you know. I said, hey, how come you don't ever drink? Are you an alcoholic? And she said, I don't know. Maybe. She said, well, you know, when maybe I am, because when I was young, I used to drink, and every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I just quit. And I said, well, you got to drink through that, you know. There, I'm preaching to the choir here. Yeah, you got to drink through that. There's a promised land beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. If I'm sick, stupid, and obnoxious, it's not even my problem. It's your problem, and especially if you're like the bride's mother or something. And so. You know, I didn't come from an alcoholic family. My parents lived for their children. They lived for their children. I don't know why I ended up being an alcoholic. I have two sisters, one who drinks, and she drinks like a normal person, whatever that is, or why they even bother, I don't know. And then I have another sister who lives in Wichita, and I went to visit her. I've never seen her take a drink in my life, and I asked her, do you drink ever? Do you, you know, go out with your friends and have a cocktail or anything? She said, well, I'll have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's. I said, what, every New Year's? You know, they call that pattern drinking. You know, I'm kidding her, but she gets defensive about it. Well, not every New Year's, you know. Why? Why not every New Year's? I mean, why not just knock yourself out? Why would you miss an annual glass of wine? And now she's really defensive. She goes, well, I always mean to. Sometimes the kids are making noise. It's New Year's. The gun's going off outside. The dogs are barking. Sometimes I just forget. Isn't that funny? Sometimes I forget to drink my annual glass of wine. May I see the hands of people who would forget? I'd be shopping wine in October, wouldn't you? I mean, but they don't think about alcohol the same way we do, you know. So anyway, I looked over my life, and I said, I don't see any deeper underlying cause and condition. I just became a drunk, you know. I remember when I was 24 years old, I went to see a show called Hair. It was 1969. It just opened at the Aquarius Theater in Hollywood, and it was about hippies singing and dancing and dancing nude and drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And I just fell in love with that show. I went to see it, and I just just was tore up from the floor up. I fell in love with that show. There was a character named Berger that swung on a rope and stripped down to a loincloth and went out in the audience and harassed everybody. He was a speed freak, leader of the tribe, and I said, I could do that. So the next day, I called the Aquarius Theater. I said, hey, I want to audition for your show. Now, you know what they should have said was, well, have your agent call us. But they didn't. They said, can you come in Friday at 1 o'clock? So I said, yeah. So Friday in the morning, I got my guitar out. I'm practicing the song I'm going to sing. And I'm, you know, because I'm thinking, maybe if I sing good enough, I won't have to dance. This is a Broadway show, and I don't know anything about dancing. But, you know, I can sing. So I'm practicing the song I'm going to sing, and I broke a string on my guitar. And when I did that, it was like, you know, hippies were like, oh, bad karma, dude, you know. So I went into my roommate's room to see if he had the string I needed. And right on his dresser, in the middle of his dresser, was the envelope with the little D string in it. I said, ah, good karma, dude. And I picked it up, and underneath it was a little white capsule. Yeah, I wonder what that is. Oh, because we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. You know, if somebody dies, you just don't eat that green shit. So it turned out it was THC. It's a synthetic marijuana and a nice little psychedelic. So 45 minutes later, when I got down to the Aquarius Theater to do my audition, I floated in there. Oh, yeah. And my hair was long over my shoulders. You know, it just swished when I walked. And I had on these hip-hugger bell-bottom pants, you know. Bells about that big, you know, when I walked in. No shirt, just a vest with six layers of foot-long red, white, and blue leather fringe. I was a walking wind chime. And they called my name, and I went up on stage, and I handed the sheet music to the piano player, and he set it up, and he winked at me, started to play. Bomp, 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 bomp. I said,
I feel good.
And see, there's your rigorous honesty. You know what I'm saying? You know, I felt very good. And so I did this James Brown song. I felt like I was a godfather of soul, you know. And I was up there doing it, and I could see the people liked it, too. They were nudging each other. This kid sings. And I got done. They said, great, man. Can you do something a little mellower for us, too, you know, just to get a range? And I said, sure. I didn't expect that, but I was on a roll, so I did Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay. I was so bad I made myself cry. and they loved it. You know, they said, great, man, we just want to see you dance. So I said, hit it. And the guy started to play, and I started to move. And my hair is coming around. And I see the fringe on this vest going. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? So they hired me, not for the Los Angeles show. They hired me to go to Las Vegas for the Vegas production. And so I went there, and I ended up doing the lead role, Berger, the guy who swung on the rope, stripped down to the loincloth, and was speed freak leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, but I could do it. And and then we did 6 months in Vegas, and we went on the road for 3 years touring the United States and Canada. And and it was just like a great life. People would come up to us after the show and say, you were beautiful, man. You were great here. Have some pot, brother. It's Sinsemean. It's Maui Waui. It's Panama Red. And go, whoa, cool. And somebody would say, hey, man, have some acid. It's sunshine. It's window pane. It's Osley. It's purple haze. Great, you know. So some girl would come up and say, "I love you. Have me." We go, "Well, okay." And so you know, it's like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Traveling around the country, and getting paid for it. It wasn't a bad job. And but I look back at that experience. And I thought, that's what happened. I was just, you know, trying to sing and dance and have fun, and they push all this drugs on me, and I had a reputation to maintain, and I started drinking, and I became a drug addict and an alcoholic and ruined my life, and I called my sponsor, Jim. I found it. What do you find now? I said, my deeper underlying cause and condition. Oh, let's hear that. He said, you know... Hair? He said, hair. Well, we don't want you drinking over your hair. Why don't we just cut that bad boy off, you know? No. Remember what I told you about the show? Remember the show I did? You know, I traveled around and I was like a big star and everything. Remember I told you about? He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. You told me you were loaded when you auditioned for that show. See, I'd already told him too much. And I said, yeah. And he said, let me tell you something. Most people, most non-alcoholic people, when they go to interview for a job they really want, won't take a drug that they can't identify. Where do they learn that stuff, you know? Isn't that what your sponsor says to you? You go, where did you get that? You know, and yeah, okay, that's right. That's right. Then I don't know what my deeper underlying cause is, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay sober. And he said, I don't know what mine is either. Don't worry about it. You know, if you want to look for it, fine. It'll give you something to do between meetings. But meanwhile, you will go to a meeting tomorrow. You will also call me tomorrow. And you will read that book tomorrow. And my sponsor used to say, read this book every day. I love this. Jim Sass, my first sponsor, said, read this book every day. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. I can't remember hearing anybody but him ever say that. And I wish that was one of our cliches, because that's, if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. You got the rest of your life to recover, but you need to stay on it, you know. And so I did what he said to do, and I finally got through the book a number of times, you know, and I still read this book. And I never did find my deeper underlying cause and condition. I finally settled on trauma from circumcision, you know. I don't know, you know. Settle on something, quit looking, and if it happened to me today, it'd make me a little restless, irritable, and discontented. I want to tell you one thing. When I was 2 years sober, my father, I was talking to my dad, and I said, listen, I owe you some money. I need to pay you back. And he said, don't worry about that money. It's nothing. You know, I don't need it, and I don't want it. It's just, it's all gone. Look at your life. That's all I want is for you to be happy. That's all your mom and I wanted for you. And I said, that's fine for you, but we got this ninth step that says I have to make amends for harms that I did, and I think borrowing money and not paying it back is a harm. I figured I must owe him $2,000 or $3,000. I borrowed it for a long time and not paid most of it back. And he said, I said, you know how much I owe you? And he said, no, I don't know, but I got it in the computer. you know, yeah, I don't need it. I don't want it. I just like to look at it once in a while. So I said, well, let me know how much it is. So he sent me a bill. He printed it all out. He had it in the computer, and it was the balance was $7,200 and change. And I lost track. it's a good thing I didn't save up $3,000. Here's the money I owe you. You know, yeah. Well, you're a little light, So I started sending my dad a check every Friday, whatever I could afford. There was no payment schedule. I'd send him 20, 30 bucks, 50, 100, whatever I could afford. And I couldn't just put a check in an envelope and send it to my dad, so I'd put a note in with it, I'd write it on a piece of paper or post it or, whatever. But I always sent him a note and a check every single Friday. I never missed a Friday. And after about 3 years, he called me and he said, do you know how much money you owe me? And I said, no, I have no idea. And he said, $32. Really? $32? Are you sure? And he said, yeah. And so we went to meet for dinner, and just the two of us. And I gave him $32, and he gave me a closeout notice for everything I had paid. And another thing happened that night. My dad reached for the check, and I let him get it. My dad always reached for the check, and I would fight him for it. Hey, let me get this. Come on, Dad. No, this is a father's job. This is what a dad does. Come on, let me buy dinner. And I never realized till I put that baggage down how much baggage I was carrying. We don't till we set it down. That I was going, no, you don't buy dinner. Let me buy dinner. I owe you all this money. Let me at least buy dinner. After I got that debt paid off, I could let him buy dinner. It didn't bother me. In fact, I was proud of him. And he was proud of me. And my dad died a couple years ago, and I was going through some stuff of his with my mom, some financial stuff that she needed to find. And I found in his file cabinet a file that said, Doug. And I pulled it out. Of course, maybe it's my inheritance, And it was. It was. It was every note I ever sent him. He cashed the checks, but he saved these notes. I opened this thing up, and there was like 150 notes, a little piece of paper and post-its and stuff. And I knew what it was immediately. And I was just shocked. I said to my mother, "Oh my God, did you know he saved all these notes?" She said, "Oh, he cherished those notes." She said, I told him one time, Doug sure loves you. And he said, I know. I got it in his own handwriting. So this is a gift that I had only because I did the ninth step. I did the ninth step because you told me that I might not stay sober if I didn't. And I believe, from my own experience and from people that I work with and friends of mine, people that I've seen in Alcoholics Anonymous, that every single step comes with a personalized gift from God, great or small. And you don't know what it is until you do the step. And then you get the gift. That just seems to be the way it works. I got this gift from my dad from beyond the grave, from trying to stay sober. I've repaired a relationship with my daughter. My daughter's stepfather asked me not to come over to their house anymore. He said, I can come over sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. And I left there, and I was crying so hard I couldn't drive because I knew he was right, and I thought he loved my daughter more than I did. And I stopped at a liquor store and got a half pint of whiskey. And once I started drinking, then I could drive again. Don't try this at Walmart. They won't understand that there either. Thank you for my life. If you're new here, in Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay until you hear the music, and you will hear it. There's a rhythm and a harmony and a melody that runs through this thing. It makes all the words make sense. And if you shared a laugh with us tonight, you've been part of the music. Thanks again.